Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, episode 31. Hello and welcome to the Plain Label Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Williams, and along with me, I have my good friend and co-host, Rachel Cruz.
Hello.
It is the beginning of another month, so of course we have a new theme for this month. We are going to sort of begin a mega theme of ours, and we're going to be covering, for the next handful of shows or so, we're going to be talking about movies and books. And so to begin, we're going to be talking about books that we've read, or at least one of us has read, that has been turned into movies. So for this episode, we are talking Sin City, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and Watchmen. Before getting into our discussion, we would like to mention that we are proud members of the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And you could also support Cruz and I by heading over to kingbonepress.storeenvy.com and pre-ordering Low Concept 3, which includes a 12-page story that Cruiser and I wrote.
Woo-woo!
Yeah, so that'd be nice of you if you went and pre-ordered that. And also you could probably support John and the other guys there at Kingbone Press and pick up some of the other stuff that's over there. That I'm sure they would appreciate it. So, Cruz, let's get into the drink roll call. What do you have for me?
Well, I just finished my Diet Pepsi and I've switched to Riesling. And what? I got some gummy bears from the store and I put them in there. So I'm like dipping gummy bears in Riesling right now. It's like a childish grown-up thing to do.
It is.
What? It's cool.
I don't know. I don't even know what to say about that. Oh boy, that threw me off. I'm going with kind of the boring beer from the Imperium Brewing Company here in Lincoln. I'm going with the Dark Side Vanilla Porter.
Yum.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Like I said, I'm not really feeling that good, so I'll just kind of take it easy today. I didn't need to get into the vodkas or the wines or anything like that.
You'll drink a cough syrupy-like beer?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what I'll do. So we're going to start off with 2005's Sin City.
Do a thing to me, Hardigan.
You'll be a risk. There'll be death. Nothing can stop this.
Time to prove to your friends that you're worth a damn.
We'll fight the cops and the mob. We'll go to war.
This isn't some barroom, bro. This is bad days. Y'all are nothing days. You're back.
Yeah. You already made a big mistake yourself.
A hardtop with a decent engine. And make sure it's got a big trunk.
Sin City is infested with criminals, crooked cops, and sexy dames, some searching for vengeance, some for redemption, and others both. The film incorporates storylines from three of Miller's graphic novels, including Sin City, which launched the long-running, critically acclaimed series, as well as That Yellow Bastard and The Big Fat Kill, where Hardigan, a cop with a bum ticker and a vow to protect stripper Nancy, Marv, the outcast misanthrope, is on a mission to avenge the death of his one true love, Goldie. There's also Dwight, the clandestine love of Shelley, who spends his nights defending Gail and her old town girls from Jackie Boy, a dirty cop with a penchant for violence.
So we picked Sin City, and this is the of the three movies that we're going to talk about today. This is the one that I had read and you have not.
Right.
And so, yeah, I guess Sin City, I'll go into sort of like a brief history of the books for me. Like, it's something that I've known Frank Miller for a while. I mean, I kind of was clued into him when he was doing a lot of Batman stuff with he's done Cruise two of the more famous or critically acclaimed Batman stories ever.
Which ones?
They are the Dark Knight Returns and Batman Year One. And the Dark Knight Returns is like Christopher Nolan's Batman is heavily influenced by that story.
Oh, okay.
To where not necessarily like plot wise, but just kind of the feel of it is very much, well.
Does he talk like this in the book?
If you want him to, if that's how you read it.
All right.
So there's that. He also did a very, very long run on Daredevil and kind of redefined that character. And then he went and did some other things, including 300, before doing Sin City.
Makes a lot of sense.
And so he does Sin City, and it's a very big departure from his normal art style. And I guess what I'm getting around to with this history of it is, I've read the three books that are contained in this movie. And if you want to read the books, you could just turn the closed captioning on the movie and just read the captions, because it is very, very, very close to the book.
Well, like in that one that you had, that you'd given me to watch, they have one of the stories in there, the one about the guy that looks like the Thing.
Yeah, the hard goodbye. It's the one with the one with Marv.
Yeah, and I had read, you know, a couple of probably the first 20 pages, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly like the story.
Yeah, and what's interesting and why I am looking forward to this sort of movies-to-book discussion is I think it's really interesting the different choices that some of the filmmakers make when it comes to adapting the books.
Right,
Because we have an example here where it's not really an adaptation. It's just kind of putting the book on screen, you know, whether it's the actual dialogue or whether it is using almost exactly the same panels from the book and putting them on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a live action version of like a motion comic or a comic brought to life, basically.
So in your opinion, do you like that, or are you like, come on, like you wanted them to use a little bit more of their own influence?
Yeah, I guess generally my thought is that I want the book to be the book, and I want the movie to take advantage of things that the book can't do. And I want the like, I don't mind that it's based on the stories and it stays close to the story, but I would prefer if they kind of use their own artistry and sort of bring something else to it.
So you want a separation of church and state?
Yeah, I do. And that's one of the things that I kind of like about 300 is that even though I don't know how, like for me, I don't know how well that movie holds up to multiple viewings. I think the first time you see it, you're like, oh, that it's cool looking at least.
Yeah.
Like, they do a lot of different things, to where here, there are some things that Robert Rodriguez does, and Frank Miller, since they co-directed this, but I'm assuming it's mostly Robert Rodriguez, but there's some things that he does that's interesting, but I just felt like, oh, of course that's what it's going to look like. Of course this is what it's going to feel like, because it feels exactly the same.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. So I guess getting into the movie itself, then, what did you think of this one? Because this is, it's obviously very stylized. It's very much a neo-noir, you know, it's
yes,
it's guns and dames and that kind
of stuff. And like I've seen, have you ever watched, what is that Dashiell Hammett book? I can't believe I just blanked on it right now. Is it the Maltese Falcon? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I'm aware of. I have not seen that movie.
And that's got why am I blanking on all these names? Anyway, that is like he's a detective, and he kind of talks like, you know, kind of like this. And so that's kind of what it harkened back to that for me, except for with one exception, I really liked the Maltese Falcon better. I feel like this, and I have, you know, like I don't, you know, I'm at a, you know, I don't have as much knowledge about the book as you do, but I feel like there's a lot of melodramatic moments in this.
Absolutely.
I'm rolling my eyes a little bit, like, oh, get out of here.
It's very romanticized.
Yes.
I think he's trying to be, or trying to make it romanticized, and it comes off as melodramatic.
It's like hokey a little bit. And I, like I said, I didn't know, because I know that you said it's like a pretty, really close depiction of the book, so I didn't know if the book... I guess like with a comic, it's just you get like certain shots of what you get to do. And I feel like if I had read the comic, that still would be way better than this movie was.
I see. And it's something that, that we'll get into when we talk about our last film, but I think that one of the things that a movie adaptation of a comic book, no matter how good the book is, loses is that the way that I read something isn't necessarily the way that it's performed on TV
or on a movie. Yeah, that's true.
You know, right. And for me, I guess getting into sort of my notes, like the first thing I remembered, or the first thing that kind of made me wince a little bit was Michael Madsen as playing Bob, who is he's Bruce Willis's character Hardigan. It's his partner.
Oh yes,
and. Exactly. It was the way that he was delivering the lines, and I just felt like, oh, this is not how I read it at all. Like this is
for like the partner, right?
Yeah, the partner,
like,
Michael.
Like right, the first time he shows up and he's trying to talk him out of it.
Yes.
It was like an eighth grade play. That reminded me of. It was so forced.
Yeah, it felt awful. Like it just did not feel right.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if, like, he started out like that, or if he, like, tried to deliver his lines like a normal person, and they were fucking with him so much that he's like, fuck it, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, this is sort of an anthology kind of a film to where there's three films going on, really. Three short films that are just kind of stitched together.
Right.
And so some of them work way better for me. Like, for me... Well, first of all, I guess I really enjoyed the sort of the very beginning with Josh Hartnett.
Yeah, see, I liked that part too, the beginning and the end.
Yeah, and I believe I think I'm right on this, but I believe that that scene was shown to the people that ended up making this film as like a test to show what the black and white would look like.
Okay.
And to sort of show everyone what this is sort of what we're going for. And I feel like those scenes are fine because I think Josh Hartnett, you know, I've been watching a lot of Lost for the Lost discussion, and he has a little bit of that Sawyer type thing where he can kind of be charming, but he also can be a little bit dangerous at times, at least in that performance anyway.
Yeah.
And well,
he has like a natural Humphrey Bogart. That's who I was thinking of.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I should have bailed you out on that one, Cruz.
Yeah, I was like, who is that? Well, like, it works in that movie. Like, it works in Humphrey Bogart movies because he delivers the lines with that sort of noir feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Only he has, like, feelings behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not just like... If I had to hear Bum Ticker one more time, I was going to, like, punch the television. Like,
you got a Bum Ticker, Hardigan.
Get it, like... But, like, the difference is, like, there's actual performance behind, you know, that style of talking. Like, I feel like with this, it's just, like, they practice so much that style of talking that the, like, feeling and the performances didn't really show through.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. You start off and you have, you know, the Hardigan thing and you know, Bruce Willis playing the rundown cop. He's Bruce Willis, pretty much.
Right.
Which is fine. Like, I think he's fine. And
Yeah, I was okay with that one, too.
Yeah, he delivers the stylized dialogue well enough. And, and then we get into the story of the hard goodbye with Marv. And if that was the two-hour movie, I would love this movie. If it was just Marv. Because for me, I like the Mickey Rourke, I'm sort of crazy, I maybe talk like this because of I'm just not that well-educated, maybe. I'm just kind of like a bruiser, like a street tough kind of a guy.
Yeah, he's gruff.
Yeah, he's just like, you know, I'm going to find him, Goldie. I'm going to find him and kill him good. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they like shoot him and he's like, what's up?
Yeah. And so he's just kind of an interesting character to where he's, you know, unbalanced and he's got this quest that he's kind of going on.
Yeah, I mean, he has like the meds and hallucinations and he's like Ryan Gosling. You're never sure when he's going to punch somebody.
Right. And so he doesn't quite look like Ryan Gosling, though, right?
No, God, no. Ryan Gosling is so beautiful.
Yeah, and where this, he knows that he's not an attractive man. He knows that he's this character that's, you know, that this Goldie wouldn't be with if she didn't have something.
If she wasn't a hooker, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that works much better than some of the other stuff, like the Michael Madsen partner stuff, like I said. Yeah, so I guess some of my other notes that I have here is, for me, like, I think Marv works well because he is, he's having fun in the role, I feel like.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
And, so then one of the things that I thought was interesting, and I wanted to get your take about on this, is, you know, people should know by now that listen to the show, you're not exactly the easiest to offend or like some kind of a sheltered young woman or something. But, what did you think about all the naked ladies running around in this movie?
It wasn't not tastefully done. I guess like if you get, like, I was expecting it the first time I watched it. I'm like, there's going to be titties in here somewhere. Like, you just know it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like his parole officer. She just like gets out of bed and just doesn't have any clothes on, and apparently that's not a big deal.
Yeah, Carla Gugino from who's in The Watchmen that we'll talk about later, who is also Pauly Shore's bride and son-in-law.
Oh yes,
yeah,
that is right.
Mm-hmm.
She's really gorgeous. I don't know if I like the. As far as the stories go, the hookers story was like my least favorite.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really have anything to do with naked women, I guess. It's just that was like, I get it. You're all like superhero type people.
Yeah. The big fat kill with Dwight, played by Clive Owen, and he's defending Old Town. And, that one doesn't really work for me either. I think that it's because there's not much to the story, really.
Yeah, there's really not.
You know, because they do, you know, he's trying to protect Shelley, and he ends up getting into a mess with Jackie Boy, who's, you know, Benicio del Toro, and he ends up getting killed, and then they kind of had that real silly, he's dead and he's talking to Dwight, but then he's got like the gun in his head sort of stuff.
That was a different guy. Never mind. Sorry.
And then we kind of have the Old Town Girls, where you have a lot of, sort of famous or kind of, or like, you know, B-list kind of actors. Like, I think Rosario Dawson's not B-list, but like, the Gilmore Girls girl,
right.
You know, people like that. And Miho, I think Miho's fun, the Asian girl who just goes and kicks everyone's ass.
Yeah.
But other than that, like, it's not, there's not really much to that one. And so I felt like that could have been a little shorter. I feel the same way about that book, though.
Maybe it's just like you weren't a fan of that story.
Yeah, yeah. And that might just be that's not my sort of thing, I guess. But
well, so like, I mean, like, I was okay with, I don't know, like, First of all, I want to see Benicio del Toro in a movie where he plays like the good guy and he's like clean shaven and he has like short hair. I just want to maybe see that work out for him and he's not smoking.
Yeah, really.
And there's something about Rosario Dawson in that like Mad Max outfit that just like completely turned me off.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because like I'm so used to her being like, you know, gorgeous and adorable and saying sweet things and she was being a badass and she pulled it off to a point, but I was like so picturing her from like Men in Black 2.
Mm.
So I was like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, like it's fun to dress up and pretend that you're a badass hooker, but like you're not selling it to me.
Right.
Yes. But, you know, that's probably just me being biased.
Yeah, maybe. So I don't know. So, and then we have the final story is with Hardigan, who, that yellow bastard.
Jessica Alba, she could take her clothes off whenever she wanted.
Yeah. That's the thing is Jessica Alba, you know, they announced that she was playing Nancy, and Nancy in the book is naked a lot.
Oh.
And so they announced that it's Nancy, and of course all of these, you know, your stereotypical comic book fan who's overweight and all that kind of Big Bang Theory type nonsense, to where when she's not naked, there is all this outrage and oh my god, you know. And it's just like, yeah, she didn't decide to get naked, like big deal, but. It was kind of interesting that she's, you know, in this strip club and, oh, Nancy's just getting warmed up. And then she's just sitting there with her, she's like more fully clothed than you see her.
Then Brittany Murphy or anybody else.
Yeah, she's like more fully clothed than anyone else that's working there. But she's the center of attention. But anyway, yeah, there's not much wrong with her dancing on the thing, though.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll go along with it.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. Okay. But last story is Hardigan, and he's kind of decides to go to jail and take the fall as opposed to letting everyone know where this Nancy is. And so he goes to jail and as this child molester. And then he ends up getting out and saving her and putting away that yellow bastard and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I feel like he put her in danger and then saved her. So she didn't really need to be, like, super grateful.
Yeah, it was like, I don't know. Like, that's kind of a weird situation because, you know, he goes, he's the cop and he goes and saves her initially. But then she still gets captured because Bob's there and double crosses him. And
yeah.
I don't know. I guess that one for me, like, I feel like I have the least... Like, I don't know if I just read that once and then kind of forgot about it, but I don't remember that one as much. And I kind of think about that Hardigan stuff, like, or that yellow bastard. Like, I think about that with the movie and the book. Like, that, for some reason, the only thing I think of is the character design of the yellow bastard, the choice to have that sickly yellow stand out so much in the film and in the book. And that's what I remember. Like, I don't remember the Hardigan stuff except for what happens to him at the end.
Well, and like, it looked gooey on his fingers. I just didn't, you know.
Well, it is 2005, so it's, you know, almost 8 years ago. So there's that's another thing on all the special features is you can see how homemade a lot of this is by Robert Rodriguez. To where he edits it all himself, and obviously he hires people to do the special effects, but yeah, it's so I don't know. So I guess I like the idea of the story. I like that they went ahead and did a modern film with all of these special effects that was shot in black and white and only chose to highlight certain colors at certain times.
Yeah, and I liked the use of shadows.
Mm-hmm.
On people. And...
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, like, that Ashley isn't really that interested in the material, but she loves the way that this book looks, or these books look, because of the use of negative space, to where everything's black instead of white, and then the characters are drawn, you know, are drawn in white instead of in black. It's like, just,
right.
You know, the opposite. And... Frank Miller does that a lot, like specifically in the movie, they capture that really well in the Elijah Wood scenes.
Ugh.
As well as the Marv at the outside of the church, where there's so much rain coming down on him.
Yeah.
Like, they do that to where the panel's black, Marv's in white, and then all those little rain is basically like slices of a razor blade or a pen or whatever, cutting white into the panel.
Yeah.
So it's stuff like that to where it does look very similar, and I like that in the ways that I like Frank Miller's artwork, but I just wish that there was more artistic license taken, I guess.
Yeah, like I really like this type of, like you said, I like the idea of this. Like, I like, you know, the woman in the red dress with the red mm-hmm. lipstick. And I, you know, like you said, I go along with some of the stories. I would have, like, my thing would be is, like, a full-length film with some of these elements, but, like, a really interesting, like, plot-filled story.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ryan Gosling.
There you go. It's not that hard, people. That's right. All Cruise wants. So,
formula, this plus this equals good times.
Yeah. So I guess I think that when I first saw this come out, like, I really loved this trailer, and I was very excited for this movie. And I think that Robert Rodriguez he's good in that he makes a lot of interesting choices and has everything look really good visually. I just don't know that he is quite put together a really solid film yet for me.
Right. He could make, like, a really great coffee table book.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's the sort of director. I mean, he's really good friends with Quentin Tarantino, and I feel like he's more stylistic than Tarantino, but his films don't have the character that
the
Tarantino.
The meat potatoes, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't. That's pretty much what I have about Sin City. I actually didn't really go by much of my notes that I had there, because it was a lot of, oh, I like this, and oh, I like this, and it was a lot of the same thing over and over. But did you have anything else about that before we moved on to our next film?
No, I mean, it was really visually pretty, and Elijah Wood is one of the creepiest people I've ever seen in my life. So.
Yeah, that was interesting, because that part is very close, where Marv's doing, like, his inventory, and he's, like, doing the rubber wire or the metal wire and his the tubing and his hacksaw and his gloves and my mitts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's very close. And then the dog's just sitting there eating him and he's smiling. Like, that's fucked up.
I know. The first time I saw it, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what came out of my mouth verbatim.
So with that, let's move on to our second film, which is a little bit different than Sin City, just a little.
Just a tad.
Yeah, it is the 2012 film, The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Dear friend, I haven't really talked to anyone outside of my family all summer, but tomorrow is my first day, and I really want to turn things around this year.
You know, they say if you make one friend on your first day, you're doing okay.
Hey, freshman toad! Forget him! Come on, hop! Let's move it, boys!
If my English teacher is the only friend I make today, that would be sort of depressing.
So, Charlie, this is what fun looks like.
Welcome to the Island of Misfit Toys.
Do you like football?
Love it.
Be aggressive! Passive aggressive!
What is she doing?
Don't worry, she does it all the time.
Do you think if people knew how crazy you really were, no one would ever talk to you?
Come on, let's go be psychos together. So what are you going to do when you get out of this place?
I'd really want to be a writer, but I don't know what I'd write about.
You could write about us.
Call it Slut and the Falcon. Make us solve crimes.
D-minus, ladies and gentlemen, I am below average!
Below average!
Below average!
Why do I and everyone I love pick people who treat us like we're nothing?
We accept the love we think we deserve.
You see things, and you understand. You're a wallflower.
I didn't think anyone noticed me.
I know there are people who say all these things don't happen. I know these will all be stories someday. But right now, we are alive. And in this moment, I swear, we are infinite.
Based on the novel written by Stephen Chbosky, this is about a 15-year-old Charlie, an endearing and naive outsider coping with first love, Emma Watson, and the suicide of his best friend and his own mental illness while struggling to find a group of people with whom he belongs. The introvert freshman is taken under the wings of two seniors, Sam and Patrick, who welcome him to the real world. That was tough for me.
Well, you can tell because these aren't professionally written, so they don't quite flow as
right. Exactly.
They should. Yeah. So it's the fault of the writer, not the reader. Cruz. Right,
not the reader.
Yeah. So the perks of being a wallflower. This one I watched last night. This is the book that you have read, and I have not.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw this movie fairly recently as well, right?
Yes.
Okay. So why don't you tell me about how you came upon the book and what kind of you thought about it and your history with it and that sort of thing.
Well, it's pretty brief. I don't want it to surprise you, but we were in the theater getting ready to watch a movie.
Oh, okay.
And we saw the trailer for this movie.
Excellent trailer.
Yeah, it was with Imagine Dragons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I always try to read the book before I watch the movie. So I can just be snarky at everybody and say the book was better. So I just went to Barnes & Noble and grabbed it really quick. It was a pretty quick read, if I remember correctly. And I just I had to make sure to read it before I watched the movie. And then we rented it and I watched it probably a couple weeks later. So the book was pretty fresh in my mind when I watched the movie. So.
Okay. Interesting. This is like you said, this is based on the novel written by Stephen Chbosky, I think is how it's pronounced.
Yeah,
but
this
is also written and directed by the novel writer.
Interesting.
Which is not something that happens very often, and that was that was kind of a nice little bit of serendipity that's how it worked out, because I wanted to highlight the fact that Sin City was basically written for the screen by Frank Miller, since it was basically the book. And it was co-directed by Frank Miller, and Wallflower is written, the book was written, and then the screenplay and the film was directed by the same guy. And then our last film is about as opposite as creator involved as it gets. So yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I'm guessing since you put it on here, this is one that you particularly enjoyed then, or what, how do you feel about this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I did like it. It wasn't life altering. There were some surprises, I guess, that I wasn't, because I mean, I don't know about you, but reading the book, he's writing a diary to someone.
Yeah. Dear friend.
Dear friend. Okay. And you get that he's kind of introverted and a little quirky. And so I'm identifying with him because he's a weird kid that likes reading books. I'm like, oh my God, did I write this?
Yeah, really.
But then, the little things start to trickle in. And in the book, it's really subtle to where you're like, shit, is he weirder than he's supposed to be? And so, it's really easy to, I feel like in the book, to trickle it in, bit by bit to where you're wondering what's going on. Then it was in the movie to get what was up, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the thing I guess I want to say first about this is you said it wasn't a life-altering sort of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Of the movies that we've watched in the year plus of the show, this is easily my favorite suggestion that you've given to me.
Really?
I loved it. Really? I was absolutely blown away by it. And I saw that trailer and was like, oh, okay, it's going to be a coming of age story. And I guess the way that the trailer looked to me, it was going to be more about Emma Watson than it was going to be about Charlie. But,
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And so I started watching it, and I think that Logan Lerman, the character or the actor that plays Charlie, I think that he has such a fine touch on knowing how to be like kind of precious, but a real person at the same time.
Yes. Cause he like, and the character in the book does that too. He like unwittingly gives more than he should and people, and then doesn't realize when he's doing something like really nice for people.
Mm.
He's like assumes that's what he's supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, my notes go like this, like my first note is Charlie is so precious. And my second note is, I love this movie already. And that's like within the first maybe 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, we spent a whole month talking about Hermione and Emma Watson, and I think that she was fantastic in this.
Yeah.
And she's so far from Hermione to where this kind of really makes me glad for her. That she's able to, or she's going to be able to separate herself from just being that character.
Right, I agree. She has, yeah, she's more depth than just a typecast character.
And what I really liked about this, and I'm, you know, I'll get this book and I'll read this book after the fact, but I like that it plays really well with the sort of light and the dark.
Yeah.
You know, like it has funny scenes. It has things that are genuinely funny, but then it also has really serious shit.
Yeah, there's like a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. And again, I think that, you know, most writers can write things that are serious and can write things that are funny. Right?
Like, mm-hmm.
It's not that part's not a challenge, but to be able to do it to where the funny scenes catch you off guard and the disturbing scenes are genuinely disturbing and feel organic. They don't feel like, what the fuck? Like, why is that in there? You know?
Yeah. Like, oh, they're trying to force you to feel this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I really, really liked was I really liked how the character of Patrick was portrayed.
Okay.
I really enjoyed that. He's a character that's homosexual, and it's part of the film, but it's not like, you know, he makes a reference to the fact that his life is an after-school special.
Yeah.
And what I like about that is, you know, I think that it's self-aware enough to where it's like, oh my God, this is so melodramatic, you know. But I really like the fact that it's played by Ezra Miller, who Cameron and I had just not too long ago talked about in his portrayal in the movie We Need to Talk About Kevin, where he plays a person behind a school murdering.
Oh.
And he's very obviously different than this performance. And those are the only two things I've ever seen him in, was that film and then now this. And they couldn't be more different, and I was really impressed by him.
Yeah, I liked him, and it's so funny, like, I try not to do it, but you obviously, like, after you see the trailer and then you read the book, you picture those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that the description of Sam in the book is different, but all I could see was Emma Watson. Like, I was like, oh, there's Emma Watson that you're talking about, but I think she had long hair. But, I mean, it doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with the... But I was watching this, and they're, like, at the school dance, and they don't give a fuck about, like, high school.
Oh, yes.
And I'm like, why was I not this cool in high school?
Exactly.
I was like, so jealous that I was, like, that lame kid in high school, that I was more of a Charlie
mm-hmm.
than these two who were, like, yeah, they get it. Like, I didn't get it in high school. I was, like, 15 in high school, and I was like, everything's the end of the world. And they're like, yeah, we're going to college. We're pretty much grown-ups right now. Like, just jealous, really.
Right. Well, and I love the fact, I really like that dance scene, too, because they're out there just not caring.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie is wanting to join in, and he's... You don't know really, like, you don't know in the film where that scene's going to go.
Right.
Because you kind of you're glad that Sam and Patrick are nice to him, but you know, you also are like, well, this is high school. They're probably going to be some clique kind of bullshit.
Right, because you've seen so many high school movies where they're like, get out of here, freshman, or whatever they say,
exactly.
You know.
Exactly. Like all the other people are.
Right.
Where that one girl, and the only job she has in the English class is to insult him the whole time.
Yeah.
Like calling him Jagoff and stuff.
The thing about Charlie that makes me like, and this was in the book too, so this isn't like something obviously because it moves the plot along in a lot of ways, but he beats the shit out of people.
Yeah, interesting.
Like because he says brother taught him how to do that. Like when he was younger, he used to get picked on and his brother taught him like moves on how to like defend himself. And so like he's super strong and he can like beat everyone's ass. It's just like a really odd characteristic for that character to have, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I thought that was nice because, you know, that's typically not what you see out of the introverted kid.
Right.
You know?
He's not usually a badass.
Yeah. I do like the fact that, like most movies that are about or that are based on a book, you will have lines that feel like a line from a novel that don't feel like a line from a screenplay.
Yeah.
And the line is, we accept the love we think we deserve.
Yeah, that's in there.
And so you're like, that's from the book, you know, you're like, that's so nicely written to where you're like, I don't know that. I feel like screenplays, like writing screenplays feel like they're very close to writing like journalism to where it's like, it has to be this certain form and it has to be this, you know.
Yeah.
You know, exterior night, blah, blah, blah. Right.
So-and-so walks in and.
Yeah. It's just like more describing and then writing the dialogue and a plot based, like it's not about the actual prose and the actual.
Well, and there is, yeah. And like with, I'm not going to advocate for novel writing or anything because that wouldn't be something I did, but I feel like there's, and I'm wrong on some levels, but there's a lot more of a big picture. I feel like in a novel than, because you're not worried about the format. You can just do whatever you want.
Yeah, you can just write.
So I wonder, like, how he... That's always a wonder for me, like, when you write a novel and, like, this guy, they let him write his own screenplay. I wonder if he just, like, copy-paste.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting that, and especially with him being the director as well, you know, I can see him, you know, planning out the days of the shoot and be like, well, this doesn't work, so we're going to have to take this out.
Yeah.
Or we're going to have to shorten this or whatever.
I was worried it was going to be voiceover the whole time because obviously that's how the book is. It's written entirely from his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So it was refreshing that it wasn't, you know, you miss a couple things, but it wasn't like anything really important.
Right. So getting into more of my notes, I guess, is I absolutely loved the Secret Santa stuff.
Yeah,
that's was very touching.
He's like nice, and he like doesn't realize that he's being overly nice.
Mm-hmm.
Like he buys presents for everybody, and they're like, "Oh my god, thanks!" And he's like, "You're welcome."
Like, yeah, I loved that a lot. I thought that going with the comedy, I love his pseudo relationship that he has, where he's too nice and he doesn't know how to break up with her.
Oh my gosh, that girl is just, yeah.
Like I was really. I really enjoyed that. I put after that whole scene was that, you know, he's so sweet and lovable that nobody better fuck with him. Is sort of how I felt as the movie was going on.
I know, like all you want to do is like protect him from mm-hmm. anything.
Yeah. And then for me, the scene of the film has to be the Sam talking about her past and wanting his first kiss to be from someone that loves him.
Yeah.
And all that. I was like, oh my God. Like I was about as wrapped up into a movie as I can be at that.
Cause that you know, like, you know, it's going to happen. So like, cause like you see the trailer and you're like, obviously he's going to have a crush on her. And like, even when the story starts unfolding, you're like, okay, I get it. Like he likes her. But like you said, he does it in such a way where you're like, oh my God, he likes her. Like, mm-hmm. it's so weird because mm-hmm. you're just like going for him the whole time.
Yeah. And so like you were saying about the subtleties of the book with it kind of delving into his mystery of his past.
Yeah.
I thought that, you know, not having any reference from before, I thought that the way that it sort of slowly reveals that something's not quite right.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, well, what's going on? And I thought that was nice because puts enough in there to where it makes you wonder. And it does have the aunt character who is, you know, his good friend and someone that he admires, and she dies. And I think that car accident scene was shot really well, and I really liked the visual of that. And so you just kind of, you know, you just kind of are like, well, what, something's up, but I don't know what. And I kind of thought it was going to have to do with, or it was going to have to deal with his best friend's suicide.
Yeah. And they, I mean, like, I don't want to say they gloss over the best friend's suicide, but I feel like it's just a setting up. Mm-hmm. Of like a character, like his character, like how he deals with it. Cause like in the book, it's almost like he's oddly deadpan about it, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like he talks about it, and there was another girl in the book, you know, or in the movie too, where they were all three friends, and he's like, I tried to talk to her, but she wouldn't talk to me. And, you know, this is kind of like, that's kind of like the, you know, how he talks in the book. He's like, and I tried to say hi, but she won't make eye contact with me. I guess, you know, people handle it differently. And like, it's just so like from right off the bat, you're like, you know, something's not.
It's just very, very matter of fact, huh?
Yeah, kind of.
Huh. Yeah. So I like that. And so you have that real dark sort of stuff. And then, the scene that made me laugh the most was, I dare you to kiss the prettiest girl in the room on the lips.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. Like, Ashley and I paused it after the first scene, or after his sort of fantasy about what he's going to say.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh my God, like how awkward. And then we push play, and it shows that, you know, it shows what actually happens when he kisses Emma Watson. And I'm like, oh my God, like it was one of the few times in film that I can remember the reality being more awkward than the fantasy.
Yeah, because the fantasy is always like your boss gets hit by a car. Or
yeah, and it's like you're, you know, I'm gonna finally tell him to fuck off or whatever. And then the reality is you just sit there and you're like, okay, yes sir, whatever. And this, it was like, oh, I'm gonna say all these things, but instead he just does something that makes things more awkward.
Yeah, and I mean, like he had been wanting to do that, you know, and he was just being honest because she was obviously way prettier than the girl he was dating. But he just does things or says things sometimes at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's like trying really hard, but he just doesn't get it all the way. And so, yeah, that was so awkward. And then like Patrick's like, you should probably go.
Yeah.
And he's like, cool, I'll go. But then like, yeah, he like spirals into that depression and like smokes cigarettes like it's his job.
And so then I guess I want to get to the end, and I want to talk about, the way that that's handled. And, you know, you have the different fight stuff, and you have the rubbing of his knee is kind of the trigger, right? Is when Emma Watson's like rubbing his knee, and that reminds him of
yes.
his aunt. And,
yeah.
And so you find out that his aunt had molested him. And for me, like, I was heartbroken when I found that out. Because that came, like, it makes sense in retrospect, but that was such a shock to me. And I was like, oh my God, this is the woman that, you know, he essentially wishes was his mother. It's this person, this confidant of his, this, you know, this best friend of his, essentially. And then it ends up being this person that had also done this to him. And my only worry was when he, you know, he goes into the kitchen and he's looking at the knife, and then it cuts to the mental institution.
Yeah.
My only worry was, oh my God, don't let this all be in his head, and none of this has actually happened, and he's just in this mental institution all the time.
I never thought about that.
And I was really worried. And when it was over, you know, I asked Ashley if she thought that. And she's like, yeah. She's like, I was worried for a second that this was all going to be fake. And that would have been horrible. Like, I would have been so upset and disappointed. But the fact that, you know, it was just, he's having a tough time. And I think that, like, I'm not really a fan of Joan Cusack, typically.
Okay.
But I think that the scene where he is playing a, like, he's not playing crazy, but he's playing like he's definitely disturbed. And I really liked that scene with the two of them because he's kind of angry about what he realizes has happened. And he's kind of, you know, not, like, I felt like he was ashamed to admit what had happened because he didn't want to, like, disappoint his aunt, or he didn't want to think about her in those ways.
Yeah, he, like, held her in such a high regard, and, like, the fact that, well, I mean, like, I don't know what she could have possibly said to explain herself, but she wasn't there to do it.
Yeah, and so that was really tough. I was really happy with the choice to have the revelation to the parents be done over a voiceover instead of having to live that scene. You know, instead of it being like, oh, well, your sister molested him, you know, and have all that, it was just done over voiceover by him.
Right, and that, you know, obviously that's how the book was, too. He's like, my parents told me this or whatever, like how that worked out. So, I mean, like, it was kind of glossed over. It could have got super awkward there for a little bit, like, icky.
And, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, then we end the film with him mirroring Sam's standing up on the back of the truck and going through the tunnel, and Heroes is playing on the radio, and
yeah,
and the tears were flowing, Cruz, I'll say that. Like, I usually say, oh, it was getting dusty or whatever, but I was straight up crying at the end of this movie.
Nice.
Like, I really enjoyed it, and it's one where it's on my Amazon wish list now. Like, the book I'm gonna get soon. Like, I don't know if it was just the mood that I was in or what the case was, but it really, really hit home for me.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah. So, yeah, I put on, you know, I wrote, wow, I fucking love that. You know, I'd love this movie already. In a different part, I said, this might be my favorite movie Cruises has suggested. So I was just like writing the same sort of things over and over in the notes. But yeah, so I was really keen on this one.
Good.
Keen, yeah. It's to sound as old as possible.
Right.
So anyway, did you have anything else that you wanted to say before we get into our last one, Cruiser?
No, I'm just really glad you enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, it's so different from the other two that we're talking about. You know, I'm sure the budget was a lot smaller, and sometimes that's all it takes.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, it was a real story.
It was maybe a little smaller.
Yeah.
Okay, so our last film, interesting enough, is not going to be chronological. Usually we go chronologically, but our last film is the 2000. Yes. Yeah, we normally do. I don't know if you pay attention to that or not.
I do not.
Yeah, we do. Our last film is the 2009 film, Watchmen.
No.
In a gritty and alternate 1985, the glory days of costume vigilantes has been brought to a close by a government crackdown, but after one of the masked veterans is brutally murdered, an investigation into the killer is initiated. The reunited heroes set out to prevent their own destruction, but in doing so discover a deeper and far more diabolical plot. Bum, bum, bum.
Exactly. So the reason that I put this last is we are doing one movie or one book that I read that you hadn't, one that you read that I haven't, and then we've both read this one.
Yep.
And so I figured it would be last. And so Watchmen is, you know, for I guess most people that read comics or whatever, it's hailed as the greatest, and they call it graphic novel. It's the greatest comic book miniseries that's been turned into a collection, which they call a graphic novel, because you hear comics and people think, oh, comics. But anyway, it's the most celebrated or the most critically acclaimed book that's out there. And a lot of that, and I guess I want to talk about the book real briefly before getting into the movie. A lot of that is about not only the story, not only the way that this sort of looks at superheroes in a real world way for one of the first times or one of the real like serious explorations into that, but also because of the form of it. And this was something you read, and one of the things that I didn't want to mention to you, but I want to see if you remember now or recollect at all or anything like that. But if you notice in the book, the entire thing is drawn in, it's drawn in 9-panel grids. So there's 3 panels at the top, 3 in the middle, 3 at the bottom. And when Dave Gibbons, the artist, needs to make an image bigger, he'll make, you know, the 3 panels at the top and then 1 panel at the bottom, but everything will always be laid out the same way.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? And so mm-hmm. if you look at it, like, that in itself is sort of a like an artistic achievement in that how disciplined and how well your storytelling has to be to draw in that style all the time. Because what you see a lot of now is you see a lot of like splash pages where there's just one image, or you see a lot of characters going through panels and it's not like a grid. It's not set up like that.
I see what you're saying.
And so I like that. I like the fact that this book has a lot of texture to it, to where there's a lot of interviews from the people in magazines, and you know, it has the first Night Owl's book that he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
It has that sort of thing to where it really steeps itself in reality, and it's like, if these people were real, how much would they be? Would they replace, you know, a Hollywood celebrity and that kind of thing? You know, to where everything that they would do would be scrutinized and watched all the time. And so I guess this was your first comic you've read, right?
I mean, besides, like, yes.
Like your first sequential book anyway, right?
I'm just going to say yes and not make an asshole. Yeah.
So I guess, what did you think about it?
It did. I mean, like, it took probably 10 pages to get used to, because I usually read books that don't have pictures in it.
Mm-hmm.
But after, you know, at the end, it's almost like just easier, I guess. Cause when you read like a novel, you have to make up all the stuff in your head about what's going on, but there's just a picture for you to see.
Right.
And it's kind of nice. Like I almost want to write a comic. And draw it, just like, I am a horrible artist, so it wouldn't look good at all. But like, it's so interesting because, like, when you're a writer, you try to get everyone to see the picture in your head that you are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And in a comic, you can just draw it.
Right.
So it works out really well for everybody.
Right.
I did like you said about the texturing, I did like that you would, you know, turn the page and there'd be an excerpt from a letter or an article or something like that, or the doctor's notes on creepy Rorschach.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. I thought it was really almost like more interactive that way. So I did really enjoy reading it. Yeah. And it took me like a couple days to get through the whole thing. So
yeah, that's one of the things that it's a dense book, specifically for comics. You know, Alan Moore, the writer, he's also the writer of V for Vendetta, which is one that we may tackle later, and we may have a special guest that was on our Harry Potter discussion who loves V for Vendetta.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a very dense writer. Like he uses a lot of narration boxes, a lot of introspection, a lot of that sort of thing. So it's interesting. But so getting into the film, I guess this film, Alan Moore wanted nothing to do with this film. Like he's kind of the comic is the comic and that's all it was supposed to be kind of a guy. He had his name removed from the credits, or he didn't want anything to be involved. So if you look, it says like Watchmen based on characters. And I think it was like drawn by Dave Gibbons. I forgot to write down specifically what it says, but it's definitely doesn't mention Alan Moore's name in there.
Huh.
And I think this is true, but he didn't take any of the royalties from all of the movie stuff that happened.
Wow.
He just either gave it to Dave Gibbons, the artist, or I don't know what happened to it. So that's not something I would do, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, my God.
So
this is a pile of crap. It made X million dollars. Well, I mean, it's not that bad.
Yeah, well, it's based on something really good. You should go buy my book. It's really good.
Yeah.
So I guess getting into the movie, we watched the director's cut, which is about 20 extra minutes.
Damn.
So this is a 3-hour beast, and it feels like 3 hours.
Yes, it does.
Like it's a long movie. Okay, where do I even want to start? First of all, I think Richard Nixon looks awful in this.
Yes, agreed.
Like he looks so ridiculous. Like I understand. I mean, obviously, I've read the book many times. I understand that it's this Nixon in 85 where he's still going strong, and it's, you know, the whole tricky dick stuff and about how he's going to lead the U.S. into nuclear war with the Russians. And but this character, this choice of costuming is so dumb. Like I thought he looked so dumb. I just didn't understand why they could just find someone that looked a little bit more like Nixon, or just put some light makeup on him. It doesn't have to clearly be prosthetics all over.
Right. It looked like he was wearing a mask.
Yeah. It looked like, what it kept reminding me of was in the 80s when Genesis had that, it had a music video where Ronald Reagan was going to blow up the U.S. because he was an idiot.
Oh.
And everyone's, it's like a puppet. They were like these puppets that they used that looked like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I thought he was just going to go rob a bank. Wear like a mask.
Like in The Town?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I didn't like that. I think that the comedian's death is interesting in that I kind of like the fact that you see it going on as opposed to it already being over, like in the book. But what I don't like is that, and this is one of my main problems with the movie, is I don't like the fact that everyone is impossibly tough and everyone knows like jujitsu and everyone is like the strongest motherfucker ever.
See, and that was one of the notes I wrote, because obviously, Dr. Manhattan has superpowers. We get it. But does everyone else?
And I think that the comedian, I want to say he is probably a little bit like stronger than your normal person.
Right.
And then Ozymandias is, I thought he was more of just like a normal guy. And I think, you know, I think Night Owl is your Batman sort of thing. And so I think he's a normal dude. Rorschach is a normal guy.
Fucked up guy.
Yeah, so I think most of them are supposed to be normal people. But all of them are so incredibly strong.
And, like, fast, and Rorschach's, like, scaling walls, and...
Oh, I guess Ozymandias is, like, juiced up a little, because he was talking about how he could catch a bullet and all that stuff.
Oh, that's right.
But yeah, so I don't know, like, I didn't, what bothered me...
It bothered, I guess, I didn't want them to be superheroes.
Yeah, me neither, because one of the things I really like about the book is that when you look at Dan Dreiberg and you look at Night Owl, the current one or the latest one, he's got a pot belly. He looks ridiculous in his suit. Like, that's all on purpose. Like, he's not supposed to look cool.
He's got nerd glasses and...
Yeah. Yeah, he's not supposed to... And he's got erectile dysfunction, clearly.
Just sad, because he's, like, super hot if he wants to be in real life.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the point, you know? Like, he... Mm-hmm. He's not some dashing, you know, like, millionaire that he goes home and, like, sees, you know, like, eats beans out of a can and, yeah, I don't know. That just, the part, like, I didn't, like, that's the what I like, a lot of what I liked about the comic was that all of the glitz and the glamour, it was, like, just completely fucking gone. And they did they didn't do a lot of that in the movie, but the whole, like, fighting and... Like, the scenes where things are pretty, I was like, okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. I guess I feel like I'm glad that the movie was made, because I like the fact that it gives more exposure to the book.
Yeah.
But I felt like I was watching more of, like, a music showcase that the director didn't necessarily understand the point of the story.
Agreed. Totally agreed.
Because I feel like Zack Snyder is, like, and I think Zack Snyder makes some tremendously pretty movies. Like, I think that he is very stylistically accomplished. I think that it's much like Robert Rodriguez, to where no one has any discernible personality or soul or brain whatsoever.
Yeah.
Like, everyone just feels so mindless. And it's like you don't ever see anyone thinking about anything.
Right. Or, like... Like, one of the scenes in here is, like, they're playing, is it 99 Luftballons? When she goes to meet him, and then she walks in, like, and I get what they're trying to do, like, they're trying to make him look clumsy as opposed to her being gorgeous, but, like, she gets her own, like, slow motion entrance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, like, we're not in a, you know, 80s high school movie, like, just have her come in and sit down and then have him, like, be awkward around her.
Right.
It's just stuff like that where... You don't, like, there are some things that needed to be pretty. Like, Dr. Manhattan's on Mars, and he makes that, like, gorgeous, you know.
Oh, whatever the fuck it is.
Right. Like, that can be pretty, because that, it's supposed to be. Like, in the comic, it's supposed to come out, and you're just supposed to be, like, awestruck by it. But, like, the little things, like, showing, you know, like, I don't know, like, just some of the other choices that he made, I was like, it's not supposed to be like that.
Right. Well, yeah. And you can imagine the people that, you know, when, like, I didn't read this until much after it came out. I mean, this came out in the late 80s. And so this has been around for almost, you know, like 25 years.
Right.
And so there's been, you know, a lot of people that have been hailing it ever since it was coming out in issues. And then to see this on the big screen and to be even more than normal, being like, no, this is not right. Like, this is not the intent.
Right.
And it goes all the way back to costume choice. Like we talked about earlier about Night Owl not being frumpy and overweight and having like the spandex stuck to him kind of a thing.
Yeah.
It's everything's got like the Batman and Robin kind of like chest protector, shiny costume on. Like where it's a little bit like protected looking, or like a, you know, like a body armor almost. Like a
rubber, yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, no, that's like, first of all, he's supposed to have gained weight, so it shouldn't even fit, you know, and stuff like that, or he should look ridiculous in it.
Right.
I don't know. The one visual that works better for me in the movie is the way that they do Rorschach's mask.
Oh, that bugged me.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. It took away one of the, I made a note of that even.
Oh.
Because I one of the reasons that I liked, okay, first of all, I just want to say that I really enjoyed this comic. Graphic novel.
Either way is fine.
Either way. And so, like, one of the things that took away from the fact that they were gritty and human was the fact that his mask moved. Like, the whole point of it was that he used it to, you know, like, get away from his mom slapping him and, you know, him being a ginger and all that other horrible things that he had to get away from. And it moved, and I was like, I mean, like, I get it's really visually interesting to see, but, like, it took away from the whole realness of what was going on, I guess.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. I guess at some point I'm searching for things that I like about the costuming and the look. And I guess instead of saying I like it, I should say it offends me the least.
Yeah, there you go.
One of the other things that I thought was completely wrong was, you know, in the book we have that Vietnam scene, and it's the, where a comedian gets his scar.
Yeah.
And in the book, you know, that is right across his face, like up almost to his nose, and it's disfiguring, like it disfigures him.
Right.
And in the movie, it's like on the side of his face, and you don't even acknowledge that it's there.
It's like a, it's a pretty movie hero scar. Where it is. It's like where the guy gets a slash on his cheek, and the girl that has been in the explosion has like a little cut on her forehead. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what that is.
Yeah. And so it's just every sort of choice like that. I just was like,
in my notes I wrote, Rorschach should be way uglier.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I just wanted everything to be like, and he's supposed to smell, and he didn't smell in the movie. Like, I wish somebody would have made a comment about that. I don't know. Like, I'm getting, like, really, like, I didn't hate the movie. It was, like you said, I liked the idea of it. I really, after, like, I'd seen the movie first, which is probably the wrong way to go. But I, after reading the book, I totally wanted to watch the movie to see how, you know, that works. And so I don't know if it's like a lazy thing, but it's just nice to see the book that you've read in movie form, I guess. I guess that's the whole point of a movie.
Is right.
From the book is like that everybody wants to see how it translates to film. And so I did, there were a lot of elements I did like, and I don't know if you are going to agree with me or not, but the times they are changing.
Yes.
Montage, I loved it.
That's my favorite part of the movie.
Me too. Totally. That's so ridiculous. That's my favorite part too.
Yeah, because I'm watching it, and it was like, I was like, oh, this is awesome. Like, it takes the images directly from the book, Sin City style, and then it puts them in motion, and then it continues on to the next, and it's like telling its own little story of the of how these people are treated in the real world. And what I really liked was, you know, specifically the one where one of the guys, well, you have the lesbian who's killed.
Right.
You have the guy with like the moth wings who's getting dragged into the mental institution.
Yeah.
And that guy, that's the sort of costume I wanted to see on the people, because I wanted it to look sort of ridiculous.
Well, and in
like, but
yeah, in like, well, and then they're all supposed to be like that, I guess. Like the 50s versions of everybody were a little bit better. Because I feel like they were just starting out trying to figure, like, obviously, what's her name? The girl was dressed like basically like a hooker, but that was like part of her gimmick.
Oh, the Silk Spectre. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause like she was supposed to be hot. Like they said in the book that criminals like wanted her to catch them.
Right. Right.
But like, yeah, like I get what you're saying.
Yeah. So I like that. Let me see where else. Oh, I knew. And I mean, I don't want to dwell on the beginning of this much longer, but I knew that I was in trouble with this movie when Rorschach throws the grappling hook and then like shoots up the side of the building.
Right.
Because in the book, he's very specifically like climbing up the side of the building, like old school Batman and Robin style, you know, like the rope is thrown and he's having to just like climb up and walk up the building.
Yeah.
And so that was like a perfect sort of symbol to me that Zack Snyder's version is going to be glitzy, sexy, glamorous, to where Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' version is real world, gritty and serious.
Right, in the way it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. In the way it's supposed to be. Okay, so getting into some of the cast, can I say that Malin Ackerman is my least favorite actress in the world ever? Is that fair? Because I've seen her in two things. And it,
who is?
Malin Ackerman, because she was in this and Rock of Ages. And I really didn't like that, if people remember that.
Well, she was also in that horrible Ben Stiller movie, too.
Mm-hmm.
She was like the wife that got married and then got sunburned or something. I wasn't really paying attention. She's okay in this. I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think of who I would cast in this film as far as who that would be. She did an all right job. She looked just like her.
Yeah, she did look like her, yes.
But, I mean, you can do that with anybody.
I guess the worst part to me has to be when they finally go out and, you know, they're fucking kung fu masters and they're kicking everyone's ass.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go up in the owl and then they're having sex while Hallelujah of all fucking things is playing.
Like, yes. Like
how on the nose can you be? But anyways, it was when it's in that scene in particular and I'm just like, God damn it. Do I not like her in this role? And I don't know, like, I just genuinely don't like her. I just feel like she, again, is everything that Zack Snyder is, to where she's just a pretty face that has nothing going on behind it, to me.
Yeah, and as far as, like, delivering the line, she did okay with that. But, yeah, I mean, like, I didn't really get that she was, like, fed up with Dr. Manhattan, you know? Like, I just wasn't feeling it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did you think about Dr. Manhattan? What's interesting is if for people that don't know, if maybe they've only seen the book, like, he is much more naked in the movie than he is in the book, which is an interesting choice. But what did you make of him?
I wanted his voice to echo and it didn't.
I wanted his voice to be as different as possible from Billy Crudup.
Yes. Like, I wanted it to be like when you we were like 10 and we got that microphone that you talk into and it echoes. Like, that's what I wanted his voice to sound like.
Yeah, it just, I don't know if that was maybe a choice to try to make it more unassuming, since he's, you know, to try to contradict it. Like, his powers are so vast, but his voice just is like a normal dude.
Yeah, but he's fucking blue, so just run with it.
Yeah, but I was going to say, whatever the choice was, is I didn't dig it because I didn't like that choice at all.
Right, well, like I'm saying, like, he's the one person where you're like, okay, he's obviously has superpowers. Like, why would you not? He should have the voice of God from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Oh, yes. That would have been good.
I did not give anyone cancer. Like,
yeah, leave me alone and all that.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like, I feel like I could go on and on and on and on about the stuff that I didn't really care for. Just in the choices that were made, and that's just kind of the way that Zack Snyder went about things. What did you think about the lack of, or taking out the entire Black Freighter stuff? Like, what did you think about the Black Freighter storyline in the book, and then the fact that it was gone in the movie?
I hated that idea.
You hated the what idea?
I wish it was in the movie.
Okay, well, interesting enough, the Black Freighter is a animated feature that came out separately, and if you watch Watchmen, the Ultimate Collection, it is cut into the story.
Nice. That was, like, so dark. It was, like, so fucked up. And one of the notes that I wrote in the movie is you turn the page of the book, and it has the doomsday clock or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. And the blood's, like, coming down. And in the book, there's, like, this sense of impending doom to me. Mm-hmm. But in the movie, it's, like, they're so fucking wrapped up in what's going on that, like, that isn't even a thing. Like, the one scene where they turn and the giant clock's on the wall and they say doomsday clock, I'm like, congratulations, you fit it in there.
Yeah.
Is what I feel like they did, whereas, like, that book, that freighter or whatever part, along with the guy, while the kid's doing that, talking about the nuclear war, like, that set up a whole another level of atmosphere going on in the book that definitely was not in the movie.
Yeah, it would be interesting. Like, I am very intrigued to have you read some other Alan Moore stuff, because that is a really good way to encompass his work. Like, everything has multiple layers on it.
Totally.
And that's why he's so well regarded as being able to use the genre of comic books in such a interesting way.
Yeah, I totally believe it. I would be up for reading whatever he had.
So he's written a lot of stuff, and I have most of it. Like, I don't have much of his newer stuff, but so I'll have to let you borrow some of that. But yeah, I think that you have to have the Black Freighter stuff in there in order for everything to make sense.
Right.
You know, because it is an allegory, you know, it is a allusion to what's going on, to where, you know, the choices that character makes towards the end, and then the choices that the character is making, the sort of villainous character is making, at the end of Watchmen. It just doesn't make sense without it.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I don't know. Well, okay, so I guess wrapping us up, sort of, what did you think about the Ozymandias reveal in the book and then how it was handled in the movie?
I don't know. I mean, like, I guess I just am such a more fan of the book that I, by the time it got to the movie part, I was like, get it over with. I feel like, I don't know.
Yeah, I can see that. When you read the book, were you surprised that he was the one behind everything, or what did you think about that?
Well, I mean, like, I had watched the movie before vaguely.
Mm.
So, like, I kind of
knew
what was going on. Like, I really fucked myself, like I said, because I should have read the book first. It would have been a huge surprise. I'm like, oh no shit. But like, there were a couple things like in the movie that I forgot, where he like hired that hitman on himself.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, when I read that in the book, I'm like, oh, yeah, you know. So, like, it wasn't, like, a total surprise, but I had forgotten some things because I had watched the movie so, like, not well that it still was, you know, interesting to see, you know, him in his Antarctic lair watching TVs, so.
Right, with his fancy cat.
Oh, yeah, his saber-toothed cat dog.
Right.
What was the name of that thing?
I don't recall. Like, it's a name where I just kind of, you know, in comics and books, when I see a name that I don't automatically know how to pronounce, I just kind of skip it.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm like, oh, okay, that's this thing, whatever. what about the comedian being Laurie's father? Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, I don't remember that part. I didn't.
Oh, really?
Part, and so I was like, no shit, like that part where she was like talking to him on Mars and she's like, he can't be and I was like, no. So yeah, that was a surprise.
Good. I can imagine you shaking your hands and
really, like, on my knees. Damn you.
Yeah, you're yep. Just like old Dan after Rorschach gets killed, you're no and all that.
Yes. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, so I guess I feel like we're pretty much on the same page, and I thought we would be, but I wanted to sort of hear your opinion on the book and how it related to the movie. But I think we can both be safe to say that the book in this case is certainly much, much better than the movie is.
Legit. I totally agree.
Yeah. So did you have anything else about Watchmen? I know that, I mean, we could have done an entire show probably on Watchmen, because there's a lot of stuff that wasn't done right.
Yeah, I could nitpick the shit out
of it. You could nitpick the shit out of it?
Mm-hmm. No, but I don't really have a whole lot to say.
All right. Well, Cruz, you're getting all staticky, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up.
Okay.
Okay, so if you have any comments for the show or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you can follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79, or Cruz. She's @cruzballtable with a K. We also have a Facebook page where you can like the show. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. You can also friend us over at Facebook under our names, Eric Williams and Rachel Cruz. If you enjoyed the show and wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com, and you're going to find Amazon links to these films that we talked about, as well as other movies that we've talked about on the podcast. So finally, please spread the word. Tell anyone and everyone you know that might enjoy the podcast and write us an iTunes review, 5 stars, of course. That's really the best way to get the word out about our little show. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Forever and ever. Oh, we can be.